you about what happens if you try to make the graviton massive. A lot of what I say is you can find in this review article here from about a year ago. Okay, so a lot of this is motivated, of course, by the cosmological constant problem. So as you all know, the cosmological constant problem is just the problem we measure the curvature of the universe from supernova. We measure the amount of matter that's in the universe, and they don't match in Einstein's equation unless we add this constant, which then creates this famously small pure number in the theory. And there's really two aspects to the problem. One is the existence of this small number in the first place, the naturalness problem. But the second, which massive gravity may address, is its stability under quantum corrections. In the Einstein theory, it's just not stable. If you start with a small number and you calculate quantum corrections, it's going to become large again. So there's really two possibilities you have if you think this is a problem. If you take what you see here seriously, so GR is all there is, and the cosmological constant is all there is, and you take the known rules of quantum field theory seriously, then it just is a problem, and your only solution is the anthropic principle or the landscape or something like that. The other possibility is to modify things. So the first possibility is the conservative possibility, where you don't allow anything to be modified. So any modification you do, the measure of success is it has to be better than the landscape. Okay, so massive gravity is really the most conservative modification you might imagine doing. It's really the first thing that should have been tried. So we want to preserve Lorentz invariance, because once you start messing with Lorentz invariance, that opens up a whole new can of worms. So we're going to preserve Lorentz invariance. Once you demand that, then you know that the degrees of freedom in the theory are classified by their mass and their spin, or helicity if they're massless. We want it to be an infrared modification to say something about the cosmological constant, but without messing up the known shorter distance tests of gravity. On the other hand, we know that general relativity is the unique theory of an interacting massless spin 2 particle at low energy. So if you believe that gravity is mediated by a massless spin 2, GR is really your only choice at low energy. So it means that to modify gravity is to change the degrees of freedom to make it something different than that of a massless spin 2. So with these things in mind, your first thought should be to make the graviton massive. So heuristically, here's what the potential for a massive particle would look like. The 1 over r is what is just the Coulomb potential that you get from a massless particle. And then a mass term will make it a Yukawa suppression like this. So if we make this mass scale to be something like Hubble today, then you're weakening this force on large distances while keeping it relatively unchanged at distances much smaller than 1 over Hubble. So this is an infrared modification that you want. So heuristically, this is the motivation for making the graviton massive. If we do this, we know that a massive spin 2 particle should have 5 degrees of freedom, 5 spin states, as opposed to the 2 degrees of freedom of a massless graviton. There's other motivations for considering this, though, even apart from the cosmological constant. One is just the field theoretic question. Is it possible to have a consistent theory of an interacting massive spin 2 particle? So even if Einstein had never discovered general relativity, had never had his geometric intuitions, general relativity probably would have been discovered later in the 60s or 70s, just asking this same question, but for a massless spin 2. So the question here is, what is the general relativity of a massive spin 2? Is there one? 2, it gives general lessons about GR. As soon as you start messing with gravity, you start to appreciate how nice pure GR is, and you start to encounter obstacles when you start modifying it. In fact, when you're modifying in the infrared, it's not always just an infrared modification. Generically, you're going to be messing up other aspects of the theory, and we'll see that at play here. However, if you believe that physics is really continuous in the parameters of the theory, so massive general relativity is going to be a deformation of massless general relativity by a mass term m. So you should recover general relativity as you take that mass to zero. If you really believe physics is continuous in that limit, it means that any pathologies that you introduce with this mass term should cure themselves as you send m to zero. So you should be able to discover in this way new mechanisms for curing any sort of pathologies that you introduce. And we'll see that in the case of massive gravity too. It will lead us to the Weinstein mechanism for screening extra scalar degrees of freedom. Okay, so with all that in mind, let's start just with the linear theory, the theory of a free massive spin 2 particle. So that's governed by the Fierce-Pauli action, which is this action here. It was discovered already in the late 30s. This is the unique action that describes a massive spin 2. Any other action that you write down is going to be equivalent to this one. And it describes just precisely the five polarizations of the massive graviton and no more. So the first part of this is just familiar as the as what you get by linearizing GR. So H would be the metric fluctuation. This is what you would get by expanding Einstein-Hilbert to linear order. And this part is invariant under this linearized diffeomorphism gauge symmetry. The mass term is this. It breaks the gauge symmetry. So this theory is just not gauge invariant. There are two possible contractions here, the h mu squared, the h squared. The relative tuning between them is important. This is called the Fierce-Pauli tuning. And if you don't have it precisely like it is here, there will be an additional extra sixth degree of freedom, which is a ghost. And then we're going to couple it to t mu nu in the usual way that you would for gravity. Okay, so you can see straight from the equations of motion that there's 5 degrees of freedom here. So you can arrange the equations into this system. The first is just an evolution equation, the wave equation. And then there are two constraints that demand that H be transverse and traceless, which eliminates 5 of the 10 components in H, which leaves 5, which is precisely right for our massive graviton.
Can I ask you?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll get to that. The answer is it's not protected, but it is technically natural to make this tuning. Okay, another way to see the degrees of freedom is the Hamiltonian formulation. So you break it up into canonical momenta and canonical variables the way we usually do. So we only Legendre transform with respect to the spatial variables. So there's 6 components in this metric. 6 canonical momenta, that's a 12-dimensional phase space. Then we see that the time-like components become, in the case of H0i, becomes an auxiliary variable. In the case of GR, when the m is 0, it would be a Lagrange multiplier. It would enforce the gauge constraints. But here it's an auxiliary variable, so it can be solved for itself but doesn't impose any constraints on the rest of the action. But H0,0 remains a Lagrange multiplier and imposes a constraint on the action. So doing all the counting, you end up again with 5 degrees of freedom. Okay, so let's look to start with at linearized solutions sourced by some point-like matter source and the interaction potential between two point-like sources. So here's the amplitude which gives you the interaction potential between two conserved t mu nus. And the thing that's different is this factor of 1/3. In GR, this would be a half. Here, it's a third. And that translates into a 4/3 in front of the Newtonian potential. So the Newtonian potential between two point masses in this theory is order 1 larger than it is in gravity by this factor of 4/3, even in the regime where the Yukawa suppression hasn't kicked in yet, even where you're much closer in than 1 over m. Then when you get out farther than 1 over m is where the Yukawa suppression kicks in, which you expect from the massive particle. However, when you calculate other observables, like the bending of light around the sun, you find that the bending of light is completely the same as it is in GR. So this is known as the VD-VZ discontinuity. The predictions from this linearized massive theory are order 1 different than GR, even in the limit where the mass goes to 0. So this violates our intuition about our demand that physics should be continuous as the mass, or as any parameter in the theory goes to zero. In other words, if this linear theory were the governing theory of our solar system, we would be able to tell whether the mass is mathematically zero or just very, very small by an order one measurement. Okay, but the linear theory is not the full theory. In real life, we're going to have to take into account nonlinearities. So to see what happens with nonlinearities, let's take as our first attempt at putting in nonlinearities. We're going to put in the nonlinearities we put in are just going to be those of GR. So the action we're going to take is the GR Einstein-Hilbert action, but then we're just going to throw on top this Schwarz-Pauli mass term. So H now is the fluctuation away from the metric, away from the flat metric. And the flat metric eta appears explicitly in the action, and that's what breaks the diffeomorphism invariance of GR. Okay, so again, we can solve the Newtonian potential. We can solve it order by order in powers of the nonlinearity in Einstein-Hilbert. And what we obtain is a series. And we see that the parameter governing this series is this parameter epsilon, which is R Weinstein over R, where R Weinstein is this combination of the of big M, which is the mass of the source, little m, the graviton mass, and Newton's constant. And this Weinstein radius lies somewhere between, intermediate between what would be the Schwarzschild radius of GR and the 1 over M where the Yukawa suppression kicks in. So what's happening is that the solution is becoming nonlinear everywhere within this Weinstein radius. And you can only trust the linear solution outside the Weinstein radius. The Weinstein radius goes to infinity as the mass goes to zero. So as you try to take the limit where the mass goes to zero, this Weinstein radius moves out, and eventually the whole solution just becomes nonlinear. So the whole VDVZ discontinuity is just inaccessible within the linear theory anyway. So it was never a problem anyway within the linear theory. So Weinstein's suggestion was that, in fact, the nonlinearities would cure this discontinuity, and in your full nonlinear theory, it would be continuous with GR. And that does turn out to be the case, and I'll show you later precisely how that occurs. Why you would want what?
For spin one particles, for instance, you don't demand that when the mass goes to zero, it becomes like a magnetism, right? You expect it to be continuous with the electromagnetism plus the Goldstone boson that is no longer being eaten.
Right, but we demand that Goldstone boson should decouple and not do anything.
But why would we? Yeah? So if we thought there was physics that could make gravity massive, why would we expect that we turn the mass off in that theory if you go to general theory and not?
Well, if it didn't, it would mean you have a situation where your physics is. You could do a measurement, which you could tell for certainty whether something is mathematically zero or not.
That's why we're not living in that world. But why is it another principle? Would you expect it to be?
Yeah, no. That this is just the bias that we do, that we don't live in such a world where things are discontinuous.
You're just saying
you can spend any scalar principle instead. It's logically possible that the world could be like this, but we do have this bias that.
But it seems it's a very strong position that you wouldn't demand another situation, right? So then it needs.
Well, I think we could demand. I mean, in the case of electromagnetism, we could demand it, and in fact, it is continuous in that case.
The same amount we don't, right? We don't ask that if we turn the W boson mass off that we get electromagnetic.
But it turns out to be the case. That is the case.
No, it's not because the scalar is in it, right? The things that the W's eight are there in the Bolognese theory, and so you couple them, and you don't couple them in gauge shunting. So in that case, the discontinuity, as I understand it, is not true.
I think it is continuous, even in the standard model. The standard model would be continuous as you take the mass of
it. It's not continuous to a purely massive spin one system. It's that plus the scalars that are no longer beneath.
Right, but I think physically still it would be continuous because that extra degree of freedom becomes so weakly. It self couples. There's going to be strong coupling stuff with that extra degree of freedom, but it's not the coupling to everything else is going to go to zero smoothly.
So the way I'll make the W boson massless is I'll turn off the gauge couplings, mm-hmm. but I won't turn off the Yukawa couplings or the Higgs couplings.
Oh,
so
okay, yeah.
What
will
happen is that the scalars are there, they couple to other things, not just the gauge bosons.
I see.
So it is continuous, but it's not continuous to the thing that it seems like you're demanding here.
Okay, I see, yeah.
We're turning that off, right? That's the way we're not turning the gauge couplings off at all. So it seems like I never really understood why this was such an important thing to
focus. Okay. Yeah, from that point of view, maybe you don't care about whether it's continuous.
You say it's continuous, but
continuous to flip, because the demand is that you turn off the mask and you go to the massless theory of a spin fusion, which has two degrees of freedom. That's the problem, right? You're saying
three degrees of freedom.
Whereas the in other situations, the massless limit is continuous to a system with the same number of degrees of freedom.
Sure.
But it has these things that present
these massive 6 5.
Yes. Yeah. So if you had some sort of a system that we know has, like a closed client system that has massive spin two guys, and you turn the masses off, you go to a system with a whole bunch more degrees of freedom, right? And that's just the way you like this. So.
Okay. Yeah, so maybe you don't think this is a demand we should impose.
I never saw it from Capella, no, so I wonder if there's a better argument.
Okay. Yeah,
you're saying fundamentally as you take the bet that takes to zero, no observable list continues to change to zero. He's saying the naive linear argument suggested that the case was different in gravity, that turns out to be wrong.
But that
makes more sense.
Well, no, the thing is that he didn't really say, but the discontinuity was that he compared the theory with the mass with the theory of just the spin two thing of the masses, right? But if you had had a scalar tensor theory, you could have had that factor of a third from the other degree of freedom, right? Or the vectors.
Right. I'm just saying there's an apparent paradox. I agree with you that
that's the way it does turn out in all other non-gravitational situations we know about.
Right.
Yeah,
so it sounds like that's a conservative thing, right? And so working hard to fix this discontinuity seems like it's a little bit out there, right?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you don't need that as a problem to motivate any of this. But let me ask, so you would say that in the standard model, if the W boson masses were too small to be measured and there was some question about whether they were zero or not, just very small or mathematically zero, we could answer that question with a finite measurement.
Right. And the thing is that the thing about massive gravity, there should be a theory of massive gravity because we know we can get massive spin two things, right? Like Kuznets and Klein towers and stuff like that.
That's right.
But they all, as far as I can see, all the ones that we know from that point of view, we have this property that when you make the mass zero, you get other things. And so it seems that that's the generic situation.
Oh yeah, that is the generic situation. Yeah.
But is there really any situation where you can spontaneously break gravity in such a way as to make the gravity massive spin two? We don't know about it.
If
it looks like line, you get the massless graviton, and then you get high in
the whole tower,
but then you just get one.
No, I don't know of any way of getting one. No. Yeah, just one.
Okay,
but the
thing
is, that's something that's not crucial for this, right? You're just asking for there to be some low energy theory of massive.
Okay.
But I don't know any other examples that have this continuity property that you're asking for here. That's the thing.
Okay. Well, in that case, this is better than the standard model. It has that as a feature.
Yeah.
If you just had a massive PhD, then it would be.
No, I think it does. That's the
standard model is because there's an extra field beyond this PhD.
So that's the only way to know of getting massive fields.
So the question is, could you take field gravity, add some massless field,
right,
and obtain a theory with a continuous mass?
Yeah.
I'm just saying, what about massive U1 ratio? Isn't that just get U1?
Yeah, for a U1, I think it's continuous.
It's just a massive vector, but it's not taking the mass at zero. Not exactly analogous.
No, because then you would have this good work here. So
no,
because
that as long as it's coupled to a conserved source, then it doesn't. It's continuous. That extra degree of freedom just decouples from everything.
Well, but it's there. So the thing is, you can't measure it.
The measurements are.
You claim I can't measure it, but you have to come with rules, right? But so if I look at thermal equilibrium, I could probably see it. So
no, you can't. You can't.
So you
the thermal equilibrium.
You phrase it as a way where the burden's on you. So the burden would be on you to find me an example of some other system which has this kind of continuity property and doesn't have another degree of freedom, which you can then argue if you see it or not.
Well, no. I mean, I think the crux of the argument is, can you see that extra degree of freedom? You can't see it. Measurements are continuous.
Well, I think energy, it might be small, it might be practically difficult to do it, but it's because it's there.
Let's take a piece of the really Higgs model.
Yeah.
Then there would be another degree of freedom, which is that physics.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is a phase of one.
That's right. That's a different thing, yeah.
So this set of models where you just stick a mass parameter in is pretty
much. Do you mean that we're discounting the being sigma? We just added a squared term.
Yeah, the spontaneous symmetry breaking case is different.
Because it's essentially, you have added a Stoeckelberg field, but then you have the Stoeckelberg field. So, So I would say that that's not a kind of tangent. Well, then the basic thing is that spin, anything higher than spin 1 and higher, you're just saying that the massless and massive representations of that spin are different dimensions. And so the thing that's continuous at that level that then turned mass up will be that you're going to get more particles than you bargained for because you had to fill up the massive representation.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to go on the list.
I'm venting here probably.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so the other problem that comes up with the nonlinearities is this Boulware desert ghost. So this is an extra degree of freedom that's present nonlinearly that wasn't there in the linear theory. So to see this, let's go to ADM variables, a Hamiltonian formulation of GR, where we introduce spatial metric, lapse, and a shift. So in GR, when we write the Hamiltonian, we find that the lapse and the shift appear linearly as Lagrange multipliers, which enforce the gauge symmetry. But in the massive theory now, we get these extra terms, and the lapse and the shift now appear quadratically. So they're no longer Lagrange multipliers, they're just auxiliary fields, which you can solve for them and plug back in. So you get no constraints on the phase space. There's now a full 12-dimensional phase space, which means in real space, there's six real space degrees of freedom, whereas the linear theory only had the five. So there's an extra degree of freedom. This extra degree of freedom is the Boulware desert ghost. Also, you can show that this Hamiltonian is unbounded. So this is a sick system. But we'll see later how to get around this. OK, so the.
Can you just ask the mass term you added seemed a bit arbitrary?
Oh, yeah, it's arbitrary. It's that's the source of the problem. So we're going to come up with a better one later.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
OK, so the modern way to see these things is this Schuckelberg analysis. So there's several problems, or undesirable features, rather, of the way that we formulated this linearized action, this Fierz-Pauli action. One is that the massless limit is not smooth. This is just the statement that the number of degrees of freedom is different. When I take m goes to 0, our gauge symmetry reappears. So we have 2 degrees of freedom in the massless limit, but 5 degrees of freedom in the massive limit. The other is that the propagator at high energies doesn't behave well. The propagator actually goes like p squared. So the familiar power counting rules of effective field theory don't work. We want the propagator to be going like 1 over p squared. Okay, so the way to reformulate this to make these features more desirable is to restore the gauge invariance that was broken by the mass term through the introduction of these Schuckelberg fields. So everywhere we see the metric field H, we make a replacement. We introduce this new field A mu based on this replacement. So the action now looks like this. We get this F mu nu squared-like term for the A. Once we do this replacement, there's now a gauge symmetry where H shifts according to this linearized gauge symmetry and A shifts to compensate. This new action is precisely equivalent to the old one because you can always go to a unitary gauge where A equals 0 and you recover the original Lagrangian. So this is better now. If we canonically normalize this A and take the M equals 0 limit, we now have 4 degrees of freedom because there's this Maxwell term rather than 5, but we're still not quite there, so we have to do one more step. We have to introduce another Schuckelberg field phi through this replacement. Now the action looks like this. And there's now a further scalar gauge symmetry where A shifts kind of like a U1 gauge field and phi shifts to compensate. Now when we canonically normalize and take the massless limit, we get this action, which does have the right number of degrees of freedom. If we do a canonical transformation to diagonalize this, what we get is a theory of a massless graviton, massless vector, massless scalar. So you can think of this just as the helicity decomposition of a massive particle in the high energy limit. The 5 degrees of freedom of the massive spin 2 at high energy decompose into a helicity 2, 2 degrees of freedom, helicity 1, the 2 degrees of freedom, and then a helicity 0, the longitudinal mode. So phi here you should think of precisely as the longitudinal mode in the high energy limit. And you see by this diagonalization that you introduce a coupling of the longitudinal mode to the trace of the stress tensor T. This is what's responsible for the VD-VZ discontinuity. So it introduces an extra fifth force, essentially, that causes the Newtonian potential to be larger than it was in GR. But it doesn't affect the light bending because it couples to the trace of T, which is 0 for light. Okay, so Also, the propagators are now all completely well-behaved. They go like 1 over p. We can use familiar power counting. And the massless limit is smooth in the sense that the number of degrees of freedom is the same. Okay, so here's another feature of the linearized theory, which is essential if you want to have this massive graviton solve the cosmological constant problem. So a small mass for the graviton is going to be technically natural. It's technically natural because as you send the mass to zero, you gain a new symmetry. You gain the gauge symmetry. So a small mass for the graviton is protected. But it doesn't tell you about how nothing protects just a bare cosmological constant from forming. So there, if this is to say anything about the cosmological constant, there has to be some screening mechanism by which a massive graviton can screen a large bare cosmological constant. So at the linearized level, this is how it works. So take the action here in its Strickelberg form, where we have the Strickelberg field A, but before introducing the phi. If we just naively integrate out this A, what we're left with is an action that looks something like this. So here, this E is the usual Einstein-Hilbert operator. So this is like the Einstein-Hilbert kinetic term. But here, it's seen through this factor, which you can think of as like a filter factor. If you bring it to the other side, what's sort of happening is that if your source T has wavelengths, which are very large compared to the M, this filter factor looks like order one and nothing happens. It just looks like pure GR. Whereas if the source has very small wavelengths, much less than M, like a cosmological constant, which is the ultimate long wavelength source, this filter factor becomes much smaller than one. And the graviton here just doesn't see the source. So the statement is that a massive graviton is supposed to be able to screen a large cosmological constant. There's no demonstration yet that this works at all at the full nonlinear level. But the linear level, there's a clue that it works.
In addition, so far it was around a flat background, so it's sort of.
That's right, yeah. There's no.
Putting the CC in there is a little.
Yeah, no one's been able to convincingly show that this works that it works at the full nonlinear level, that if I just stick a root G in the action, that it really prevents the space time from curving.
If you phrase the argument the same way, if you went back to the original graphic, if you just asked, and I find a solution. If I just add the cosmological, the idea that I take T nu and I make it a cosmological constant.
Yeah.
And then now if I look for solutions, I look for flat space as a solution to those equations.
Yeah.
That would correspond to, I guess, H is A to me nu.
That's right, yeah.
And so I should see that if I can't solve those equations by taking A equals zero and H equals A to me nu.
Yeah, I guess an easier way to see it is just from here. So in this formulation, the equation of motion for phi just enforces that the linearized curvature is zero. Okay. So now we want to extend this Strickelberg analysis to the fully interacting theory, to study the effective field theory of the fully interacting massive graviton. So to do this, we have to restore the full nonlinear diffeomorphism invariance. So we make a replacement now. Every time we see the metric, we replace it with this combination, which is patterned after a full diffeomorphism now. And the field Y here are the new Strickelberg fields that we're introducing. Once we do this, there's now a diffeomorphism symmetry, the same one that we have for GR, along with this transformation on Y, which compensates. We can then expand this around the unitary gauge, introduce the further longitudinal Strickelberg like we did before. And now the replacement rule we have becomes this long, complicated thing. So everywhere we see the metric fluctuation, we make this replacement. The linearized parts are exactly what we did for the linearized theory, but now there's all these nonlinear terms that we need to add to take into account the full nonlinear diffeomorphism symmetry. So we're going to take this thing, plug it up here into the action, and you're going to generate a whole slew of interaction operators. And then the question is, what does this look like as an effective field theory? So all these interaction terms now, after you canonically normalize the various fields, look schematically like this. There's some number of powers of phi, each with two derivatives, some number of powers of A, each with one derivative, and some number of powers of H. They're all non-renormalizable interactions. This is a non-renormalizable theory. There's going to be some interaction scale in front of each term. And the question of what is the strong coupling scale of the theory is what is the lowest such scale that appears out in front of all these terms. So you can ask that, and it turns out that the lowest possible scale, the one that sets the strong coupling of the theory, is the one that appears in front of cubic self-interactions of this longitudinal mode phi, so operators that are schematically of this form. And the scale that appears is the scale lambda phi, which is this geometric mean of the Planck mass and the graviton mass. So this is the cutoff of the effective field theory. It's parametrically higher than the graviton mass, so it's a consistent effective field theory that includes this massive graviton, but it's much lower than the Planck mass. So it's not valid up to the same scales that GR is.
Is one way of thinking about your Stueckelberg field that if I had kind of filled the world with a space-filling brain or something like that, and thought of Y as being the position of that brain.
Yeah, it's exactly
then
that.
It's
yeah.
like an induced metric. And so then it seems like the way you're going to break the, give it the things of masses, you'll choose the action of the brain to, so the ground state's not translation invariant and Lorentz invariant, and you've broken the symmetry that
yeah.
was making it
mass. Yeah, it's precisely that. Yeah.
But if saying it that way makes it sound like, so is it hard to, if I kind of thought of what the action would have to be to have a ground state like that, do I have to do anything funny? Because it sounds like if I want to get gradients, I don't want to have, one way you could do it, which may not be the only way, but one way is if your gradient energies were negative or something, then the theory would like to have ripples everywhere. But then you'd be worried about that you have negative energies or gradients, and that would be unstable. So if you phrase it as an action kind of a question, Is there an example of an action which you know is kind of bound and below and has a property that it's minimized in a non-Lorentz invariant place?
So I guess the action, this massive gravity action in that language is precisely such an action.
You start expanding in terms of powers of the phi's, you lose all the compactness that was in when you run in terms of the induced metric. So if you run in terms of the induced metric, is there a simple thing you can write down?
I'm not sure it's any simpler than, I think what you're asking for is what we have where I just keep everything packaged in terms of the y's rather than expanding it all out.
But the thing is that I always just, once everything gets expanded in powers of all fields, then it's hard to know where it came from. If you wrote down a brain action in terms of the induced metric, it doesn't have to be very complicated, right?
But I think the induced metric is exactly what we had.
Yeah, that looked like it was what, but the action, so if I wrote
the action for the y's, that's what it says.
Is there a simple action I could write for the y's which would kind of do everything you want to do?
So I think it would be just this term where this interaction term now is going to be a mixing between the dynamical G and the induced G.
No, but I see it. Supposing
this
I
is the action.
I don't aim at that term. Instead say, I'm going to just break down some action for the brain, and I won't try and get that term, but I'll design the ground state not to be translation invariant. So I'll break the symmetries that we're making the graviton massless. So then I should be for free getting a term like that when I look at low energies.
Yeah.
But I would have more control over whether the action was something I had other worries about.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure you have more control because so what you're allowed to write down by these rules would be anything that is a diffeomorphism-looking invariant thing of the induced metric and the full metric.
But I'll stick in. So if I had to kind of guess how to do it, I'd stick in vectors that are explicit vectors that this action knows about. So if I start writing funny indirect, I wouldn't normally write down in a Lorentz invariant way.
Yeah.
Because normally I'm trying not to have a mass for the graviton. So if I So I have, I don't know if anyone sat down and looked at what the most general actions are. You can write that number under the back order. Is there kind of anything systematic you can do along with
that? I think so. I mean, it's just you're going to be trying to write down any diffeomorphism invariant involving two metrics, basically the induced metric, the full metric. Any diff invariant constructed out of these things is allowed.
Okay.
So any scalar which is just contractions of the induced metric with the full metric is allowed. Any scalar of that is a possible mass term. So it gives you much more than you want even here, because this is just one possible one of those mass terms which happens to give you just the mass of graviton and nothing else.
Yeah, but the reason that I'm kind of resisting that a little bit is that I'm trying to do the analog of what, if I was doing spin-1 particles, what you're doing is kind of the analog of running the Goldstone boson theory below the scale at which I broke the symmetry.
Yeah.
But I could have instead asked, what's the theory above the scale where everything's linearly realized?
Oh.
I actually know what the bev is that broke the symmetry. So I have an action which is invariant, but the solution wasn't. So if I tried to ask that same question for the gravity language, that would be like an algebraic completion. And then the thing is, the trick would be, is it going to be hard? Because the trick is normally getting the bev that breaks the symmetry without having it be sick at some level.
Yeah.
But I can ask it better in that language. So I get this knowledge.
Okay. Yeah, let me
think
about
that. I guess the question is, have people thought that through, or is that something that...
I don't think so. Yeah, let's that's good. But yeah.
Can you write things down like G alpha beta, Y alpha, Y beta, something like that, without any group, please?
Yeah, you can. That's essentially what this is. Yeah, maybe there's another formulation of this theory that I'll show you later that might. Okay, so let's look more closely at this cubic Lagrangian. So here's the precise form of the cubic Lagrangian with all the tensor structure intact. So this, to get this, we've taken a limit, this decoupling limit, where we send the mass to zero and the Planck mass to infinity, but we keep that strong coupling scale lambda 5 held fixed. So all we're doing here is just zooming in on that leading interaction. And this is what's responsible for all the nonlinearities in the theory. In fact, it's responsible for this Weinstein radius too. If we ask for spherical solutions of this thing, the Weinstein radius is precisely the radius at which this nonlinear term starts to become comparable to the kinetic term. So in this decoupling limit, we're taking this Yukawa scale 1 over m to infinity. We're taking all the Schwarzschild type scales to zero, but we're keeping intact this nonlinear Weinstein radius and the 1 over lambda 5 cutoff. So this is the scale at which we're going to be working if we're talking about solar system tests of this theory. However, this theory had a ghost, the Wohlwehr desert ghost, and that's apparent in this action as well. It's just the fact that this action now is a higher derivative action. So it has fourth order equations of motion for this phi, which means there's really secretly, nonlinearly, 2 degrees of freedom in this phi as opposed to 1. And you don't see that around flat space, because around flat space, this is just an interaction term, which you treat as a perturbation. So it's just 1 degree of freedom around flat space. But as soon as you start to solve around different backgrounds, around a spherical background, for instance, so take the phi and expand it in fluctuations curly phi around some spherical background like that sourced by the sun. And if you expand the action and you look at the fluctuation terms around this background, you find that they're higher derivative. And if you, so there's 2 degrees of freedom propagating around this new background. And if you ask for the mass of this second degree of freedom, it's proportional to 1 over gradients of the background. So around flat space, it's the mass of the ghost is basically being pushed to infinity. But as soon as you go around some non-trivial background, the ghost comes down and starts to be a problem. And it's not a problem until the mass of the ghost drops below the cutoff of your effective field theory. So you should ask, at what radius does that happen? And that's this radius I'm calling R ghost. Everywhere below R ghost here, the ghost is below the mass of the ghost is below the cutoff of the effective field theory. So you shouldn't trust anything below this ghost radius. This ghost radius is much larger, parametrically larger than the Weinstein radius. So in fact, everything within the Weinstein regime, all the nonlinearities and everything, you just couldn't trust anyway, in the sense that it had a ghost. Okay, if we ignore that ghost for a second, though, and ask how is continuity with GR recovered, if you ask for what this scalar profile is around a spherical mass like the sun, you find that at distances much larger than the Weinstein radius, it just goes like 1 over r, that's just the linear Yukawa term, but at distances much smaller than the Weinstein radius, that interaction term is dominating, and you get this funny r to the 3/2 type potential. And if you ask then what is the Newtonian potential of this phi compared to that of just Newtonian gravity at distances much larger than the Weinstein radius, it's order 1, you have an order 1 fifth force. But at distances much smaller than the Weinstein radius, like in the solar system, it's suppressed by this factor of R over R Weinstein. But if you look more closely at how this suppression is actually achieved, so you can take this fourth order Lagrangian and write it in terms of two fields with second order Lagrangians. One of them has the wrong sign kinetic term and it's a ghost. And you find that the way that this scalar field is canceling is that if you have a ghost scalar, you know that it creates a repulsive interaction between particles. So what's happening is the repulsive interaction of the ghost is canceling the attractive interaction of the extra degree of freedom, which is causing the Newtonian potential to be zero inside or small inside the Weinstein radius. Whereas much larger than the Weinstein radius, the ghost is not active and you just get the suppressed full fifth force. So it's a pretty sick mechanism by which you're restoring continuity with GR. but this is going to be better behaved. I'm going to skip. This is about the quantum corrections, but basically, a small graviton mass is technically natural. Also, quantum corrections start to become important exactly at this ghost radius. So in fact, the ghost was never a problem quantum mechanically anyway. Everything within the ghost radius can't be trusted quantum mechanically when you ask about what are the operators that can be generated and when they become important. So there's no regime, here's the summary. There's no regime in this theory where anything can be trusted and is nonlinear. The only trustable region, which is okay from quantum corrections, is the linear regime. Everything nonlinear is just out of control quantum mechanically. Okay, so this was the state of the field up until a few years ago. So recently, basically all these problems have been solved. And the problem was we just didn't have the right interaction term. So we want to go back and ask, what is the most general possible zero derivative interaction term that we could have written down as opposed to just the Fierds-Pauli term? So we're going to keep the kinetic term as Einstein-Hilbert. The interaction term now we're going to let be completely general. So at linear level, it's going to be this Fierds-Pauli. So these parentheses, these are just all possible contractions of the H, traces and such. And then for the interaction, we've just got all possible combinations with arbitrary coefficients. Okay. So the goal is going to be to get rid of these scalar self-interaction operators that were causing the cutoff to be so low and that were causing all the nonlinearities. So these self-interactions here. So we're going to Struckelberg this theory in the same way. And now we're going to demand, order by order, that these scalar self-interactions cancel out by tuning these coefficients. And this can, in fact, be done. At every combination, at every order in phi, there's a combination here of the second derivatives of phi, which is a total derivative. So by tuning those coefficients appropriately, we can arrange the scalar self-interactions to appear in total derivative combinations. Once we do this, self-interactions of the scalar will be gone. Turns out there's a three-parameter family of ways to do this. One is going to be the graviton mass, and then it's really a two-parameter family beyond the graviton mass. And once we do this, we will see that the cutoff has been raised to this higher scale, lambda 3. And the operators, which are now the leading self-interactions, are things with a single tensor and then products of the scalar. If we look now at the Lagrangian in this decoupling limit, this is now the interaction Lagrangian. So phi here is again the longitudinal scalar, and these x's are various combinations of contractions of the scalar. C3 and D5 are those two parameters, the family ways of doing this. These x's have remarkable properties. They're identically conserved, as is required from the nonlinear gauge from the Struckelberg gauge invariance here. Also, the structure of the time derivatives appears in just such a way here that there's, in fact, no ghosts. So this is a purely, despite the appearance of higher derivatives, this is a purely second order theory. And the ghost has been eliminated from the decoupling limit. So this was not asked for. This theory was arrived at just by demanding that that the cutoff be raised, but that these self-interactions of the scalar be gone. But then for free, we've gotten that the ghost has gone away as well. You can diagonalize scalar tensor interactions by making this type of change of variables. And what you find then for the scalar self-interactions is something that looks like this. So these scalar self-interaction terms now, these are known as Galileans. They're higher order, higher derivative actions, and there's no way to get rid of the higher derivatives by integration by parts or anything like that. And yet the structure is just such that the equations of motion are exactly second order. So there's only one degree of freedom here, despite the higher derivative interactions. Also, there's this symmetry, this Galilean symmetry, where we shift the field by a constant and we're allowed to shift its gradient, essentially. This is here just by virtue of the way we made the Struckelberg replacement. Every time a phi that was there, it came in with two derivatives, so it had to have this symmetry. But here, the symmetry is realized slightly in a funny way, because not every phi has two derivatives. So in fact, these terms change by total derivatives under these symmetries. There's also, these terms have remarkable quantum properties. In fact, you can show that these particular terms within this effective field theory are not renormalized at any loop level. There's no diagram you can write that will renormalize them. They're like Wes-Zimino terms. Okay, so you can also show that the Weinstein mechanism works in this theory. I'm going to skip this because of time. And as I said before, the quantum effective field theory is now very well behaved. So here's the summary of this new good mass of gravity with the right self-interactions. There's now, when you ask where do the quantum operators become important, those things you didn't write down in the quantum, in the classical theory, they are they're not important until you get to a radius which is this 1 over the cutoff, whereas the linear, nonlinear regime kicks in at the Weinstein radius. So now in this theory, we have a parametrically large window in which nonlinearities are important, and you get a screening of the fifth force, and you can be consistent with solar system tests, and yet the quantum effects can still be ignored. So this is a great improvement over the theory with a ghost. You can show that once you make this choice, so you saw that the action I wrote down was in this decoupling limit, which is free of ghosts, but in fact the theory is completely free of ghosts to all orders beyond the decoupling limit. So these people have done a Hamiltonian analysis of the full nonlinear theory and shown that, in fact, there's no Bolwer-Deser 6-degree of freedom at all. It's a 5-degree of freedom theory, completely nonlinearly. And it possesses this Weinstein screening mechanism, which now is under control quantum mechanically. Okay, so it turns out you can resum this entire theory with this order by order choice of coefficients. You can resum it into a form that looks like this. So here, this is Einstein-Hilbert again. Here's the mass term. So it's written in terms of these characteristic polynomials, S, which are just the contractions of things you get when you expand out the determinant of a matrix. And it's written in terms of this matrix, which is a square root matrix of the inverse of the full metric times the background metric. So the background metric appears explicitly here. That's what breaks diff symmetry. So this is the structure that appears.
There, you mean the resumming works, I mean, even if eta is not in the cosmic energy state?
Yeah, I'll get to that. It works, yeah. It turns out there's a much nicer formulation of this theory, which makes easier to see what's going on. So Rachel Rosen and I were able to rewrite this theory in terms of fear binds. And when you do that, these possible mass terms are nothing but all possible ways of contracting the full dynamical Fearbine with just the unit Fearbine representing the Minkowski background. So you can think of these as just sort of like a generalized bimetric cosmological constant or something like that. And you can show that this is perfectly equivalent to the theory before. And in fact, in this formulation, it's almost trivial to see that the full theory is ghost-free. So in the previous square root formulation, when they showed that was ghost-free, it's a very difficult calculation. But here it's almost trivial. It's when you pick the right gauge for this, a convenient upper triangular gauge for this Fearbine. In fact, the structure of the mass terms is just such that the lapse always appears now as a Lagrange multiplier and enforces extra constraint, which gets rid of the Bolwer-Deser ghost. Okay, so what Latham was hinting at, that background metric doesn't have to be Minkowski. In fact, it can be any metric, any fixed metric, and it will still be ghost-free. It can even be any additional dynamical metric. So you can write down a bimetric theory, which is patterned after this this interaction. So now we have Einstein-Hilbert for the original G, but now we also write an Einstein-Hilbert term for what was the background metric, G bar. And we use these same special interaction terms. So this is now going to be a bimetric theory. We can write it schematically with this diagram, drawing a circle for each of the metrics and then a bar to indicate that they're interacting through one of these special ghost-free terms. At linearized level, there's going to be one massless graviton and one massive graviton, which is 7 degrees of freedom. There's going to be one diffeomorphism invariance, which is an overall diff symmetry for both of the metrics. generically, if I were to write any old interaction term there, there would be a Bulwer desert ghost associated with the massive guy. So there would be 8 degrees of freedom nonlinearly. But with this special structure, there's in fact only 7 degrees of freedom nonlinearly. And in the Fehlbein formulation, it's just all possible, the mass term is just all possible ways of combining the wedging the two Fehlbeins for the two metrics. Okay, so you can continue this. You can construct any sort of multi-gravity theory you want, where you have a dot to represent a bunch of metrics, and then you draw lines for any of them that are interacting. And we were able to show that any way that you want to make these things interact, so you can, as long as you use those ghost-free interaction terms, the resulting theory that you can construct will be completely ghost-free. So one special case of this is a gravitational deconstruction of extra dimensions. If you draw this diagram to look like a circle, for instance, you're going to approximate the Kaluza-Klein spectrum of graviton compactified on this space. So this is the way, so now we can realize this deconstruction program without ghosts. Okay. So there's also other interactions you can write down if you have more than two metrics. So in fact, you can write down any potential interaction which mixes up to four metrics. So you can have interaction terms like this, which mix three of the metrics. There's three possible ways to do it in four dimensions. And you can draw vertices like this, and you can add it to your theory, and it'll still be free of ghosts. And you can have one possible four-metric vertex like this that you can write down. So all these things are just sort of multimetric generalizations of the cosmological constant that you could write down. So now you can make any sort of graph with any of these vertices, and the resulting theory will not have Bulwer desert ghosts, and will have this higher cutoff. And the longitudinal modes now will self-interact through multi-Galilean theories. There'll be a longitudinal mode associated with each of the massive gravitons. Okay, so in summary, I think that these theories of massive gravity with these higher cutoffs, this is as good as it gets as far as modified gravity is concerned. This is that they're actually sensible quantum effective theories. They're not just things you arbitrarily write down. They may have something to say about the cosmological constant depending on whether the degravitation program can be made to work. But even if not, this is the interesting field theoretically. Just is there a possible consistent effective field theory of just a pure spin two? And this is what it looks like. So the 40-year-old problem of the Bulwer desert ghost has been solved. It makes use of these Galileans, which I wish I could talk more about. These are interesting theories in their own right. There's a lot of work now has been done on cosmology. There's interesting possible signals, which I could say more about. There's still some sort of underlying topological structure that seems to be at play here that we don't understand too well. These Galileans are like Wessumino terms of something. We don't know what. And there's still the issue, of course, of UV completion. These are still effective field theories. Is there any possible UV completion of these? So that I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
What about black holes? For example, I imagine people have already obtained the sort of static solution.
So black holes are confusing. It's not completely clear what occurs. But the basic problem is that in these theories, it's not diffeomorphism invariant. So anytime you have what was a coordinate singularity, so something like the horizon, which is a coordinate singularity in GR, in this theory is a true physical singularity because you can't do any, there's no coordinate freedom to, no diff symmetry to say it's not physical. So you tend, when you just naively solve the spherical solutions, you get singularities where in GR you would get horizons.
And now what if you use just so that then there, for example, for Schwarzschild, there are non-singular coordinates to describe them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so you can use the tortoise coordinates and things, and then, but it's still confusing. People don't. Yeah, if you try naively to do these non-singular coordinates, you find that the Struckelberg fields become singular.
People don't have black hole solutions at the moment that are non-singular outside the horizon.
That's right. Yeah, there's no convincing non-singular black hole solution, but it's not much work has been done in this respect.
Okay, so this is for this class of theories, how does the clash between the Newtonian potential and the vacuum of light?
Yeah, so that's resolved by this Einstein mechanism. So the bending of light is the same as in GR. It's the Newtonian potential that was the problem, the force of this extra scalar, and that scalar is screened by this Einstein mechanism. So we wouldn't see any extra force within the solar system. It's a lot like in DGP.
So the upshot is the solar system doesn't reveal anything.
That's right. Yeah, barring some sort of coincidence where the scales are just right, so that we could just see the effects of this screening. Right. So to make this solve the cosmological constant problem, you really have to convincingly say that the degravitation works nonlinearly. So you would set the graviton mass m to be the Hubble constant, and that can explain the acceleration of the universe. There are self-accelerating solutions you can find, and that small m is protected quantum mechanically. But that's not enough. You have to say that if I stick a bare cosmological constant in there, one that was generated by other fields or whatever, that bare cosmological constant doesn't curve the space-time. So that's what you really have to have the degravitation working to claim that you have a full solution.
So with the challenge there is that people have not done it at the nonlinear level?
That's right, yeah.
So is it that is a quartic interaction no matter how many metrics you have? So you can have, even with a single metric, you have this core metric interaction, but if you have more than one metric.
Let's see, so you need at least four metrics to have this quartic interaction that I showed, because each metric is different.
Okay, so that's different than that L4.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And when you said that it's a three-parameter family, you mean there's three of these different sort of epsilon contracted terms that you can write down, and that's maybe 4D, and there's...
Yeah, that's right. So in D dimensions, there'd be D minus 2 possible.
But the idea is that only one of those metrics is relevant from the solar system scale. What happens to the other ones?
Yeah, so the idea is that only the massless graviton is the one we actually see at play in the solar system.
That's some kind of combination of other metrics?
That's right. That'll be some linear combination of the actual metrics appearing in the Lagrangian. Yeah.
Is that a hypothesis or assumption that the particles we see fall to geodesics are one of those metrics,
yeah,
and not the others, or do you mean that's...
That depends on how you couple the matter in, which is your choice, yeah.
That's what you mean. You wouldn't avoid writing down a theory where trying to couple sensors.
That's right, yeah, those other things would be ruled out. Yeah.
And is that the sort of thing that's expected to be protected? Like if you start by writing down a matter theory with the distance to one?
Yeah, so I didn't have, yeah, that's, so even the Schwarz-Pauli structure is not strictly protected. So all these tunings we had to make are not, well, nobody knows for sure, but in the worst case, they're not protected. You do get corrections, but you can show that they're technically natural in the sense that the deviations you get, like, if you start messing with the Schwarz-Pauli tuning, you're going to be introducing another sixth degree of freedom, but that sixth degree of freedom you introduce always has a mass above the cutoff, so it's technically natural in that sense. Same with the higher tuning.
You said that one of the things was the it's not known when you don't derive a completion. So if you set things up for the cosmological constant problem, what is the scale of the derive a completion event where something has to happen?
It would be this lambda 3.
What is that numerically?
If you take values of m to be the Hubble constant and the usual Newton constant, then it's something like 1,000 kilometers, so 1/1.
I see.
The energy scale of 1,000 kilometers.
Part of the, so then that means that for the cosmological constant problem, probably degravitation itself is not sufficient in the sense that normally what you'd have to do, the dangerous stuff is normally the high energy stuff, right, not the low energy stuff.
Yeah.
Being safe under quantum fractions for low energy stuff is some cool comfort. And so the question would be, if you can't embed it, you'd have to know what the ultraviolet collision is to know when you integrate something really heavy, to what extent is it screwing up the choices you made at low energies, right? It's,
yeah.
It sounds like that's actually open until
yeah.
you have an ultraviolet collision.
That's right, yeah.
So you do have one ultraviolet implication, which is that ring, which is supposed to be the Kaluza Klein tower. Is that right?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So a Kaluza,
so,
yeah.
I mean, you could, an ultraviolet implication in the sense that it's really a manifestation of gravity and higher energies.
Yeah, so a Kaluza Klein tower isn't precisely a UV completion of this, because the Kaluza Klein reduction also has additional modes besides just the metric. There's
right.
a scalar radion, and there's other stuff there, so it's not,
right.
not strictly a UV completion of this, and even that's not UV complete, but
it's UV completer than this.
It's, yeah, it's more complete than this. Yeah.
Can you do you have any speculations as to what all these other graphs could mean in that context?
Yeah, not really. I mean, it's a generalization of the Kaluza Klein stuff,
right.
and that you can write down discrete dimension and things like that. But yeah, it.
And how much more does the Kaluza Klein really have? Just
the
vector. Say I need 5D.
So yeah, so the only extra things it has is a vector mode, a vector zero mode and a scalar zero mode, and it has an infinite number of fields as opposed
but
to a finite number.
You have a scalar as well.
That scalar that I showed was the longitudinal mode of the massive graviton. It wasn't a pure massless scalar that would be there in addition.
So
Kaluza
Klein without the scalar and vector might be equivalent.
Yeah, modulo the fact that there's an infinite number of fields. That's right.
So that kind of comes back to the beginning of your talk, because Kaluza Klein is pretty much designed to be in the weak field region when you're analyzing it, and so that's why you've got this, you know, the discontinuity is there, because your limit as you turn the masses off isn't going to gravity, because you're in the weak field region, and so you're stuck with the space you have.
Yeah, yeah.
So 1,000 kilometers sounds surprisingly within the range of possible experiments. Is there anything observable that even in principle is those? I mean, what, you know, there's some cutoff at 1,000 kilometers.
That's right. Yeah. So all dynamics within the solar system is safely larger than 1,000 kilometers. So there's potential observable things there. So. This Weinstein mechanism is extremely effective, so it basically screens everything you might try to detect. But if there's some coincidence, like the Weinstein mechanism is just starting to kick in at the solar system or something, there could be some small deviation somewhere that you could see. A lot like with DGP, and the people said you could test DGP by looking at the moon because there'd be small deviations if the parameter were right. So something like that is possible, but it would take some coincidence.
Well, that's a good question.